Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 339th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Debbie Bradshaw, Luke Cheney, and Sean Wenning. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we're talking fake trailers, how to shoot them, the ins and outs, and all of the fun of pretending like you shot a whole movie when in fact you only shot the little bits and pieces that would go into a trailer. There's a lot of good reasons why someone would want to make a fake trailer, whether that's for a proof of concept or a crowdfunding campaign or a parody or comedic purposes. Oren and I have done that a handful of times actually over the years. It used to be Oren's bread and butter, as you said off mic, and I just shot one this week, so I thought let's talk about fake trailers. But before we do that, Oren,
yes,
I've been dying to know, what have you been working on lately?
Well, Matt, thank you for asking. I've been pitching and I've been doing a lot of VFX work. It was a pretty fun pitch, but there was the client is really sensitive to, basically the client, what they make is illegal to sell to children. It's not cigarettes. We're pitching on a comedic commercial and they really want to make sure it does not seem like it appeals to kids. But the concept is kind of fantastical and youth-like and might remind you of like a Pixar movie.
I can think of a category, you know, your vices, right? Your lottery tickets, alcohol brands, things like that. Cigarettes, vapes. Is it in that category?
Yes, you've actually named the product.
Perfect. Okay, good. Good.
It's not a cigarettes or vapes, though.
Gotcha. Okay, great.
Anyway, so I needed to reference, you know, movies and other things that had kind of this heightened reality and fun elements in them, but that do not appeal to kids. I think I might have mentioned this to you. I've always done my treatments in Pages, Apple Pages. And then if I work with a treatment designer, they usually use InDesign or something. But I've kind of realized that everyone wants to see video, like wants to see something moving, right? Mm-hmm. That PDF document that just has a bunch of beautiful stills. Maybe it's good for like a lifestyle shoot or something. I don't know. Something super technical, but
you're saying though that just GIFs and embedded videos are the lingua franca of decks.
Well, we're pitching moving pictures and let's say you're pitching against two other directors and the other two directors, one of them makes like a cool video and a proof of concept or something for the commercial. One of them makes this incredible deck, like living deck that's animated and has all these cool movie clips and maybe an edited like a reel of like favorite moments or something from movies that remind him of this commercial or her of this commercial. And then you're coming and you just have a PDF document with some like beautiful images and really great writing, but it's just very static. You're already starting from a losing place a little bit. And especially in the world of comedy, I think, you know, having like a little animated something or other, like an animated GIF, yeah, can really help sell tone, sell mood, sell visuals.
I agree. I've been leaning in on animated GIFs.
Yeah, and it's annoying because they're like 30 megabytes for the worst quality 2-second clip you've ever seen.
And significantly more work. You know, like all of a sudden now I'm like, okay, well, I'm downloading a YouTube video and then I'm editing it and then using GIFGUM, which is a previous unpaid endorsement of yours, to like animate it.
So my workflow for it is I download movies, TV shows, commercials, whatever, videos that I make myself even, and I put them all in Adobe Premiere.
When you say videos you make yourself, do you mean you animate something in After Effects or Premiere or something like that? Or you mean you shoot something?
I shoot something or I use stuff from my own spots or I use like an animatic, like a lot of times in my treatments, I like to talk about the process because when you're working for a client on something that you did not write, and I imagine this would be the same with like a studio too, if you're pitching a movie or something, they want to know that you're collaborative, right?
Mm-hmm.
They want to know how you work. And it depends. Maybe if you're like, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson or something, people just want you to go and do your own thing and they don't care how you
go
do
be
it.
A genius.
They just want,
yeah.
But, you know, the rest of us that are more like working, you know, all together and listening and taking notes and input and everything, we want to show people that like our process is really open to input from the invested parties. And so a lot of times in my treatments, I talk about how I make animatics or how I make storyboards or how I do various things to show them what it's going to look like, to make sure that when we're on set, people aren't like, oh, what? No, we can't shoot it like that, because on set, we don't have time to completely change things. So I take my animatics or I'll do things like that and I'll put them in my treatment, like on a page on process or on how it's going to go down or how we're going to pull this off.
Do you ever recycle any of those assets?
Yeah. I mean, I did this like Five Gum commercial where this Twitch influencer, Lily Pichu, she's playing this video game, the Avengers video game. And there's this character in it, Kamala Khan, that she like hits the ground really hard with her giant fist. And in the commercial, like it shakes the entire room and everything goes flying up in the air in slow motion. And the way I shot it, and if anyone follows me on Instagram, I'm sure they saw, is I just had everyone on the crew like pick up an item in the room and I just rotoscoped them all out, you know, in post to make it look like things are flying in the air. But anyway, so I take all these videos, I put them in Premiere, and then I just set in and out points, you know, and just export animated GIFs from Premiere.
You export GIFs through Premiere rather than using GIFGun and
After Effects? For treatments. I would use a GIFGun if I was making a GIF for my website, somewhere where I care about how fast it takes to load. Because GIFGun can make like a great looking 6 megabyte GIF. And in Premiere, that same GIF would be 16 megabytes.
Yeah.
But with a treatment that I'm putting on Google Slides, like a slideshow or a deck that's made on Google online, it can be a 20 megabyte GIF because, first of all, I think the way Google Slides works is it preloads all the remaining pages. You just have to, if you're looking at the first page, it's already loading the GIFs on the second and third page. So it's just, I think, a more acceptable way to look at a document. Like, I would never send anyone a PDF that's 200 megabytes, but I would send them a link to a Google deck that had 500 megabytes worth of animated GIFs in it if it's spread out on enough pages. Does that make sense?
It does. It begs the question, why aren't we just using InDesign?
First of all, InDesign is just much more complicated. Like changing fonts and things like that is, you know, you kind of set up like, this is my header font, and this is my title font, and this is my caption font. And sometimes you want to change one and it's changing everything else and you have to unlink and relink. And it's complicated. The second thing is with the Google Doc, which I love, like I can work on my laptop. I go to my desktop. It's on my desktop. I can look at it on my phone and you can send a link to it and update it like, oh, shoot, we got to change this thing out. You can update it like underneath people's having the link. You don't have to say like, please ignore that last PDF file. Here's a new one.
I think you can do that with InDesign as well. I think you can send live links.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you can. Yeah.
Yeah. But then you have to package it. I mean, I've done so many treatments where like the treatment designer's like, oh, I'm having an issue with InDesign right now. Right. Do you have it? Right. Can you export this? Anyway, so InDesign is great. InDesign is way better. If I was doing like a feature film movie pitch that I was taking to movie stars and top Hollywood agencies and stuff, I would probably
do that. Design.
But Google Deck, Google Slides, I can go much faster and I can even before I finish my writing, I just have my pages laid out. I send it to the producer who's like trying to figure out the budget and he's already like looking through my things and even giving me notes before I'm even like done. So I like it. So I needed to find a scene where somebody is like sneaking in to a house that was comedic, but not
creepy,
made for children, not targeted at children. So I called you and you didn't answer. And then I called Andy Young because he's, you know, been on the podcast. He's like a film encyclopedia and he had some good recommendations like Ace Ventura and a couple other movies. But I realized if you go to Giphy.com, the animated
Giphy is the secret weapon for sure.
And all you not to pull the GIFs, actually to get ideas from where to pull the GIFs. So I typed in sneak and it's like, here's this funny scene from Schitt's Creek. Here's a funny scene from Arrested Development. Here's a funny scene from this
movie. You
can
even pull those GIFs sometimes, but I like the idea of being like, oh, reverse engineering, going back to the Schitt's Creek episode or whatever.
Right.
If you can find it. Yeah.
Schitt's Creek, clearly not a kid's show. mm-hmm. also very funny and also mm-hmm. has scenes of people sneaking around, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's kind of this idea I got, like, use Giphy to figure out which movies mm-hmm. have a good, like, car upside down scene, you know, whatever right. it is. Yeah. Because it's like a searchable image library of 100%. Pop culture.
Yeah. So, love that.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Well, before we talk about me, Oren, I know that you're also doing a lot of VFX, and off of the mic before we started rolling, we were talking about a few of the shots that you're working on, and it made me wonder if you could throw out three tips for novice or just for filmmakers on how to make your VFX shots better once you get them into post. What are the three? There's three no-nos that you named to me just in the moment, basically, that may seem obvious to people who do VFX, but may not be for people who don't do them.
Well, so this movie I'm working on, there's a lot of screens, and I'm going to mm-hmm. talk about production things. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Okay. Yeah, yeah. When you're in the field, yeah. things to make it easier on your VFX artist.
So don't shoot with the screens off.
Yep, that's a great one.
Right.
I have made that mistake myself and made you do the shot, and we ended up reshooting them instead. It yeah. would be much, much, much easier to reshoot them.
Wait, sorry. But just to be sorry, and there's actually more specificity. If you're mm-hmm. outdoors shooting someone looking like at a phone, mm-hmm. then you can shoot with the screen off. If you can shoot with the screen just with white on it, that's great. If people are interacting and crossing in front of the screen and you can shoot it with green on it, it could be helpful as long as that green isn't making everything else in the scene green. Mm-hmm. So exterior, daytime, it can be off. Would be okay. White screen.
I'm going to put a big caveat with having the screen off yes. during in the day or wherever, because this is the problem that I ran up against. At the time, I had an iPhone 10. There's no tracking mark. It's just a black mirror, pun intended. And so you don't know where the screen starts or ends. There's nothing to track onto. It's just one solid surface. So if it was off, what would you do then, Oren?
Yeah, as long as the shot encompasses all four corners of the phone, or there's a hand holding it and the hand is not moving, I would use the hand to track the shot and the corners of the phone. But yeah, that it is hard to determine where the screen starts and where it ends if you have a black bezel around your screen, which is why just a white screen on is really great. And again, green is great also, as long as it is not coloring other things in the scene green, which it wouldn't exterior daytime. If mm-hmm. you're nighttime interior or nighttime exterior, the monitor now or the screen becomes like a light source. And that's why it's really important to have it on, because otherwise the lighting is completely wrong once you put the screen in there. And also having it on is a great reference for the visual effects artist to know how bright things are. And it's an even greater reference for the cinematographer to know what aperture they should be using on the camera, like what exposure the camera is set to make sure that the screen is not blowing out. And otherwise you're starting to make, if they shoot it with the screen off indoors, it's really dark. And then you add a screen, but nothing is lit.
It just looks
fake. In reality, it would be so bright because the camera, the exposure is so high that it would be just fully blown out. But now you're obviously not making it blown out because you're the VFX artist and you can make it legible. So anyway, long story short, have the screen on in dark environments is my recommendation.
That's a good recommendation. And it also brings up a major pet peeve of mine that I'm trying to grapple with. And that's that I shoot a lot of commercials, and oftentimes, most of the time, in fact, I'm shooting a phone screen, both as an insert and it's in their hands. I shoot a lot of phones over the last couple of years because that's the product shot, basically. And the VFX artists that we work with oftentimes will give me an unrealistically legible and clear and bright screen. And I'm always like, oh, that doesn't look how it would look in real life. But if you looked at the footage, the raw footage, you'd see that like there's a ton of reflections on it. And like even at a phone turned up all the way to its max brightness in a medium shot in a day exterior means that you can't see crap on that phone. And when that's your product shot, you need to be able to see whatever app we're advertising. And so I've had to like make peace with the idea that my VFX shots are for phone screens in particular are going to privilege the product and be heightened no matter what the reality of shooting those phones looks like. And so to me, actually shooting with the phone off so that you can gather all those reflections tends to be a moot point. And I've moved back to just like either white or green.
And I know I used to really be pro screen off, but I've kind of shifted a little bit. And then tracking markers too. We've said this a million times on the podcast. Do not put like giant pieces of tape on the four corners. If anything, put tiny, tiny pieces of tape configured as in a square in the middle of the screen, not close to the edges. Because as VFX artists, we have to remove those pieces of tape. And if they're covering stuff that's difficult to rebuild, it's hard. But if they're just in the middle of the screen, you can just kind of like clone stamp some pixels right next to them. But they're still trackable. The other thing, again, this is on screens. It's all visual effects, but just think about focus. Remember that your camera focus should be set to where it would be set to if the thing was in the scene, right? So like this movie I'm working on, a lot of the shots, the computer isn't that in focus, you know? Like the actors are in focus sometimes, or the desk is in focus and it's really shallow depth of field and they shot anamorphic. And so the director's like, this is a little blurry, you know, the screen. And I'm like, well, I'm just matching it to the computer. The computer is blurry, you know? So I can make it sharp, but it's going to look a little fake. Just obviously think of focus. And as a note, and they actually talk about this on VFX Artists React, the Corridor Digital show about VFX. It's better to shoot everything sharp and then defocus it in post than to shoot the thing that you think needs to be soft. Like it's much easier to push things out of focus than it is to bring things into
focus. So yeah, that's interesting.
If you're ever like, wait, should we have focus here, this, just like, it's better to shoot your elements sharp, you know, if you know for sure it's going to be out of focus.
Yeah, that's interesting. Your elements sharp makes me, obviously a plate is an element. So that makes sense. I guess I was like, if I was shooting like, literally an object on green screen that then we were going to add in or something like that. Certainly that makes complete sense to me. And I understand theoretically why a plate being 100% sharp would make it easier. But I guess I get a little worried that then things get lost in translation. Like I think of a plate as the blueprint, the guide. Yeah, exactly. Because I would be annoyed, frankly, and this is a communication thing and a time thing, but I would be annoyed if I wanted most things to fall off and be soft, but I shot it off sharp and then got the VFX back in 100% sharp. And then,
yeah,
you know,
well, then your VFX artist is not good. It's pretty much
well, or more likely, I didn't communicate clearly to the VFX artist, hey, this zone needs to fall off, but we shot everything sharp for you to just make it easier on your life. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Hopefully a VFX artist understands like how cameras work and stuff. They were talking about The Boys on that show, and they, you know, when they shoot explosions and people in front of them flying, they shoot, they're not using green screen. They're shooting everyone in the same place, but they are shooting the explosion separately and the people flying separately. And then some people in the foreground watching like over their shoulder separately. And they said that they shoot everything sharp, even though these are layers, like, you know, the people whose shoulders are in front of the camera are like 5 feet away from the camera, and the explosion is like 300 feet away from the camera, but they're shooting them all in focus and they're building these layers of depth. And
let me ask you, and then we should move on because this isn't a VFX episode, but I like that very much. My rudimentary VFX expertise or understanding, I would, if I was going to do that shot myself, I'd be like, great, I'm going to do all these pieces, and then I'm going to throw some sort of blur on each of these elements, basically a 2D 3D move, right? Like throw slap Gaussian blur on the shoulder that's in the foreground or whatever, and just eyeball it, right?
Yeah,
I guess the right way to do, or the smarter way to do that, would be to build it out in 2D 3D, like throw it, turn them into 3D objects, skip, put them right into the right spot, and then let the camera do the rest. What's the right way to do it, and is it helpful, more importantly, is it helpful to shoot a reference where the focus is where you want it to be for the final piece so that the VFX artist can reference the blur later?
It's always helpful to get references of the blur and all that stuff. I usually eyeball that stuff. I sometimes use the Gaussian blur if it's like something super blurry, far out of focus in the distance. But if it's like a more like a rack focus or something, After Effects has a camera lens blur that does a pretty good job. You can set it to like how many blades the aperture of your camera has, and it makes the bokeh, like the out of focus stuff, kind of accurate, but it's a really expensive effect. So if you have like, if you're doing it on like 20 layers,
you mean cycles wise, you mean the process,
like it takes a long time to render. But yeah, so I think, you know, if you're using like Nuke or something where you have a little bit more of a 3D environment built into your compositing software, you would do that. But yeah, I think it's literally just what looks good. So my last thing, and it'll be real quick, is like, just be aware of your lenses and VFX. Like this movie I'm working on, shot anamorphic, beautiful lenses, but it's like total bananas, like on the edges of the frame. Like it's, everything's distorted. And when you're adding VFX elements, especially things that need to go on and off camera, on and off the edge of the frame, in theory, they should match the distortions of your lenses. If you're using really wide lenses or anamorphic lenses or you know, vintage lenses, just know that the quality of your VFX will depend on your lenses, and like, you don't have to do anything special, but just like know about it and maybe even mention it to your VFX artist before you shoot and see if it's a concern. Maybe you can do a test or, like you said, a reference to show how things distort differently at the edges of the frame.
Yeah. Yeah. References. The yeah. And also easy enough to get. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So yeah. So three random VFX tips. I have a million
solid
complaints. Yeah. About how
I have more questions about lens distortion, and I feel like I've heard a lot of people talking about chromatic aberration as their secret sauce for VFX shots, but maybe we'll talk about that in another episode.
Yeah, I actually like to use that. Chromatic aberration is when I'm making a fake computer screen.
Sure.
I like to put a tiny, tiny, tiny bit on it.
Just a kiss. Yeah.
But yeah, it's way overused in like the AI art and then the like CG. You know, 3D rendering world.
I mean, not as an aesthetic. I mean, as a kind of like another way to blend things in the same way that adding the appropriate lens distortion helps merge your VFX with your.
It's the imperfections that make things feel real. Anyhow, so I've been doing that. Hopefully I'll have some fun shoots coming up soon. I'll let you guys know. But before we get into our main topic, real quick, Matt, what have you been up to? And I know it's related to our main topic, so feel free to segue from what you've been up to our topic.
Yeah, I shot a fake trailer this last week, the 2-day shoot, which was nice. We had a little bit of time to kind of dig in, and it made me nostalgic for the good old internet comedy days where I think you and I were shooting fake trailers pretty regularly, actually. And this one, not unlike those other ones, was really fun because it was emphasizing a specific genre and style. And so you could lean in on things a little bit more. Jokes were very easy to come up with because you kind of all understand like, oh, we're parodying this type of movie. I did it for College Humor with like kind of like a more modern horror movie that was a tie-in to Get Out, basically where we took like feeling awkward at parties and turning that into a whole horror genre, basically. Oren, you've done a couple more like that. What are your fake trailers that you've done?
Well, so when I worked back at Disney, there was like, this is like 10 years ago, but Viral 101 was just take a trailer and make fun of it. So, you know, we did like the Twilight Before Christmas where Santa Claus was like a vampire and basically copied the Twilight trailer. And
but so you were lifting specific moments. There would be the moment where he's like, say it.
Yeah, say it. Santa.
You're right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it's just so fun to come up with those things. And remember I did all those Quiznos things. So I did like Star Entourage, which was like I did these mashups, Star Wars meets Entourage and House of Thrones, which was like House of Cards meets Game of Thrones. And, and so, yeah, so you pull things from one movie and, you know, bring the characters of another movie. Like what if the characters from Harry Potter were in, Succession or something, you know, like how would that be like, oh, they'd just be doing magic to like change stock portfolios or whatever. So yeah. And it's like, literally we would just make those and they would get like, you know, at the time 100,000 views, which was a lot. Now it's like any idiot gets 100,000 views, you know?
We say that, like, I think that
it's not true.
That's not true at all. And it's just more that like, oh, every talk show, the Tonight Show gets 100,000 views on everything they post.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's usually just not room for sketch comedy on the internet anymore.
It's weird because I feel like I came up just copying shots from trailers. I'd be like, ooh, this, we did that whole thing with Maze Runner where like this guy like slides, you know, under this door that's closing and running between these maze walls that are closing in on him. And we just built the maze walls and we just closed them in on our guy, you know, who was.
And yeah, it's like, instead of this, it's a sandwich.
Well, the Maze Runner was the Waze Runner. So these kids are using Waze to try to find their way out of the maze, you know, and
it's
always screwing them over. Were you doing more of a genre parody? Like
more genre. Exactly.
Oh yeah. So I did that Charmin commercial where like the roommates are, nobody bought toilet paper and it's like a horror film.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's easier when you're more specific than that. But
it's funny, in this one in particular, I got a little dogmatic early on and had to back off of like, well, are we talking like John Carpenter? Or are we talking Sam Raimi or whatever? Right. Like,
which are like pretty similar in this grand scheme of like
in the grand scheme of things. Yeah. When you're just posting a fun video to the internet to sell some product. Yeah. Right. But like. And I did get pushback that was like, I referenced Mandy and they were like, Mandy's too gross.
And but I was also that's like a,
they got
a
the
mainstream
reference. Yeah. But the reason I mentioned Mandy specifically is because I was like, well, I can get some colorful lights and fog easy.
Hmm. Yes.
And so the reason oftentimes horror trailers work well is because for the same reason that horror movies work well, there are certain elements that are quite overt that are still affordable that get an emotional response from people. And whether you're doing that for fun, for jokes, or trying to actually scare someone, sound effects and darkness and a little bit of fake blood go a long way.
Right. But were you trying to make it like purposely tropey? Like, hey, here's the bathroom mirror. We close it and someone appears, you know, monster appears.
Well, so that's what we, yes, to the first part of your question, we were trying to make it specifically tropey, but what tropes specifically we were trying to hit became the thing that sort of, the thread that unraveled the sweater, so to speak, you know, and took us a while to dial in on.
And were you, was there a product you were advertising or something?
Yes, there was. And that I'm just alluding to, I'm not saying specifically because it's still in progress.
Is it a lottery ticket?
No, it's not one.
One in a million
chance.
You
got the ticket.
Let me ask you, when you are going to do a horror parody, do you hire the DP that you've worked with 100 times? It's like amazing and you're really good at, or you have great relationship with, and they can do everything? Or do you hire the horror DP?
So I was lucky on this one. I went for somebody who I knew had done it before. He shot one of my previous horror pieces, the thing I did for College Humor and Get Out. So I knew we could do that style really well, but also he shot a lot for College Humor. And so I knew that he had a lot of versatility, because what ends up happening when you're shooting a fake trailer is that for two setups, you're in a bodega, and then you move the camera around and you've dressed the other end of the room to be, you know, the president's office or whatever. And so you need somebody who's nimble and quick and gets it and can make it feel like everything makes sense together, like it is actually all gonna be in the same movie. But at least with this one, part of the fun was like, what movie has all of these elements in it? You know, like we were really going hard in the grab bag of like, you know, we're like giants or like kaiju style fights over a miniature city in one moment, and then, you know, neon fog in another moment, and then a clown or what, you know, all
and these
just
are
all sorts of crazy stuff.
The same movie.
It's all supposed to be the same movie. Yeah.
Yeah. What I find hard with those things just reminded me, like, one of the biggest issues I would have is we would have enough money or time to build like 3 of the 7 sets we need.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then we would cheat one with like sky or whatever.
Yes.
And then we would do green screen, and then we'd edit it together with the green screen. It would feel great, look good. And then we'd go do the VFX and we're like, this sucks. Mm-hmm, it went from like a pretty high production value product to a pretty cheesy looking video.
Yeah.
Did you have any green screen or did you do any of that
stuff?
We
did, but it was all kind of intentionally, knowingly, winkingly green screen. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I was curious, Oren, when you were shooting. Yeah. Locations was a tricky thing. We found there's like a handful of standing sets in Los Angeles. This is one of the things that's the most fun about Los Angeles. It's like, you know, you can go to a location that's customized to have a jail and a hospital room and a, you know, a classroom all in the same location. And so every once in a while, you're like shooting a sketch series or something, an anthology, something really eclectic. And it lends itself really well to these fake trailers. And you kind of end up writing around it a little bit. You're kind of like, well, we've got this prison cell. So we went to a new spot called Avenida Studios. They've only been open for 6 months.
Mm.
They were awesome. They rolled out the red carpet for us.
And were you doing yours? It was a comedy, right? Like you're making fun of trailers.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I think in the intro to this episode, we were talking about when you would make a fake trailer, and you had brought up maybe as a proof of concept, or you're trying to sell your sci-fi film or your drama or something else, like a rom-com. Have you ever done that, like been part of a fake trailer that's not making fun of trailers? Because making fun of trailers is just much easier. And you have all these cards, right, that are making jokes, right?
Like right, yeah.
In between. And you are trying to follow that three-act structure of a trailer, but you're kind of making fun of it as well.
Right.
But when you need to make something that's not comedic or that's not a spoof, it's harder. What's your experience with that?
Yeah, so my breakout web series, we'll say, Squaresville, which is about 10 years old now, we kickstarted the first season and we needed footage, you know, like I'd cast everything. I just needed a little bit of money to get it going. And I'd written this fake trailer based off of the first handful of episodes that I'd written. I kind of like, I was like, okay, well, I'll pick and choose things a little bit. And I added a few little scenes that would sort of hint at the tone and vibe and scope. And then it was one of the first things I'd ever really done. You know, I think about it all the time because I knew so little that I was kind of always surprised that it cut together even, you know,
right.
Like, oh, this worked. I can't believe it because now I know all of the mistakes that I was, you know, it was just kind of like blindfolded and teetering along the edge of a cliff for 2 years. The thing that you realize very quickly is that it's hard to have actors give you one line, oftentimes the most important emotional pivotal line of a scene or a series arc or whatever, without just shooting the whole scene. And also, I learned that you may think you know what's going to be the best thing for the trailer, but you probably don't. You probably should just shoot the whole thing. And that's what we ended up doing, is we ended up shooting at least the scene from which each line was lifted.
Oh, interesting. And did they make it into the final show, final series?
Yeah. Yeah, they did. They did. So what ended up happening is that I would do kind of like longer form hero episodes. And then I would do what I called mini-sodes, which were just like little vignettes that were meant to be a minute and a half long or so. They'd probably just be a TikTok now, that weren't nearly as story oriented. And those were the ones that basically I shot and then used them as Kickstarter incentives. So whenever we hit a certain threshold, I would release a new mini episode.
I never did that. I mean, I might have like shot a scene that had like five lines of dialogue and then cut it down to three lines of dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
I do find with when I did a lot of those fake trailers is that it would be a little less like a real trailer has like one or two lines per scene. And my fake trailers would have like three or four lines a scene. You
You'd
know?
Have just like tight little scenes, basically. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're setting up a lot of things and you're making fun of something that exists and you're trying to, you know, do something. You're working on multiple levels. So sometimes it helped to have just a little bit more
just
dialogue.
A little bit more mileage. Did you ever find yourself being like, okay, I know I'm going to cut into the scene a little later, but I just need to give this actor like a couplet or two just to get them into the scene, you know?
Yeah.
Like in sketch, you call it chuffa, right? Like that's the non-sequitur mm-hmm. before you get into it. So like, well, Oren, I can't believe you paid for the check. Thanks so much. Oh, Obama, you know, right. Like,
yeah.
And also, Obama is the important part, but like, you know, you need something just to like,
right.
Fill the gap between walking through the door and taking a seat at the bar or whatever.
Yeah. And I would do that. I shoot like entrances and exits that you never really need at all. But a lot of times you're like, oh, we have a little gap. What can we put in here? Mm-hmm. Should we get some stock footage, establishing shot of the city, or should we just like take a shot of our actor like leaving the room, you know,
mm-hmm.
from a different scene and just kind of stick it here in slow motion?
It makes me think of, I've been shooting a lot of testimonial style commercials lately that I'm sure people have seen on like Hulu or basic cable, a lot of like stuff that like is meant to feel and oftentimes is just shot on a person's cell phone. Mm-hmm. You know, just like, wow, I can't believe this thing showed up right on my doorstep. It's delicious or so easy to use or whatever. And it's real people shot on their phones just talking about how good a product is. And I've realized that in those montage style pieces that what I've really needed in between sound bites of like, wow, this is so easy, I had no idea or whatever, or like you gotta listen to Just Shoot It, is a little exclamation points, like just a person going like or like wow, or like like those moments are hard to script and really important.
Yeah.
Like the things that you need more than anything else, honestly.
All of that stuff is super important. It's getting the little pieces. But I got to be honest, like, I don't know if nowadays I would shoot a trailer as a pitch for a movie. I think shooting like a scene, if I was pitching like one of my projects, I would probably not make a trailer just because I know it's not going to be good, you know, mm-hmm. like it's going to feel kind of cheap and I'd rather just shoot.
It doesn't have famous people in it.
Yeah.
You know, you just kind of, you see the actuality of it and it kind of bums people out. Yeah.
Well, it's like those parody trailers I was saying, like if you make a fake trailer for your movie and half the shots are great and the other half are like, just feel really cheap, kind of brings the whole thing down. Mm-hmm. But if you can get a scene and then a deck and then, mm-hmm. you know, that you're even a Rip-O-Matic, obviously, like you've done fake trailers as pitches using footage from other movies. I think
and I'll say
that's
this
easier.
One time I got really good feedback on it. And then more recently, I put one together that people didn't respond to, frankly. And I don't think it was empirically that the quality of the piece was bad. I mean, you saw it. It was like there were maybe instances where it would be better to have a different movie or whatever. But like, you know, when you have a whole internet's worth of clips to choose from, most people, I think, can put something together that's legitimately cool. But it's always going to be a half step off from what you want it to be. You know, it's like, I know that I've got too much Seth Rogen in this, or like, this person, this actor is too old for the character, but the shot is perfect. And I know the color temperatures don't really match. And I tried to get them, retime them, and they just look a little muddy. So I let them, you know, there's a lot of excuses and caveats no matter what, unless you're shooting custom footage.
Yeah, doing that, but you're not judged on them, you know, because you didn't shoot them. So
sure. Good point.
But
no matter what I'm saying, it's the potential is that it still wouldn't. It didn't help, I guess, in my circumstance, though I wasn't judged in the same way that you're describing.
I feel like your Rip-O-Matic that you made, your concept is just like really unique and your tone is unique. And I think sometimes, especially in treatments and stuff, we try to average out our tone by combining like things that sit on either side of it. And sometimes it works and sometimes it just muddies things up a little bit. So, you know, I think the reason we make these things is to clearly pitch our ideas to people. And sometimes I think with a project like yours, like the script and your verbal pitch maybe does a better job of selling the tone than things that are like kind of like, it's kind of like this and it's kind of like this and it's kind of like this. And this is kind of the rhythm. So I don't know. That's just kind of me thinking about it. Cause you had done the one before, you know, a couple of years ago that I thought was like, just like a real, real perfect setup. Like I could see the movie from that Rip-O-Matic, but that it had,
that's the one that got negative responses.
The gun one? We bought a gun?
Oh no, that one did. That one got well. Yeah. That was well received. Yeah.
I think what worked about that one is it was a little more like a dark Apatow film or something. You know, like you can kind of describe it in like two words. And I think your new movie is like, it's a little bit of like genre bending in a way that I don't think you have a ton of great comparables. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And just to get specific for listeners so that we're not too vague, to your point, I think you're averaging all of the different elements out. And my film, I call it a comedy horror because it's funnier than it is scary. But as soon as you put one shot from any horror movie, even if no one's getting slashed and burnt or whatever in it, it does cast an aura around the rest of the piece that just feels like, oh, this is scary or this is dark or whatever. Even though that's not exactly what I'm aiming for with the film. So we'll see.
Yeah, it's tricky. And I think trends change too. Like when you had that kind of killer and Rip-O-Matic that everyone was excited about, it was like a time where people hadn't seen like a million of them, you know? Now I think you've seen so many. I mean, me, you know, I've been like boasting about my awesome PDF treatments for years. And now today I'm like, eh. Those are boring.
It's over.
Things change. And I think a little bit about trailers too. Like, I think they're not as novel a tool to pitch as they used to be. And I think even in the comedy world, like as a spoof, I mean, from a guy that must have made like 30 or 40 of them. Like, I don't know that I would watch one as readily as I would have back in the day when it was a little harder to make them. But now that we're kind of oversaturated.
I mean, I think that there was that magic time in the internet where like you would see a trailer mashup. You'd be like, oh, Brokeback to the Future, or like, Shining was a comedy or something like that, where people were just remixing video footage in a way that we literally couldn't have done.
Yeah.
You know, 2 years before that.
My boss at Disney cut this one called Must Love Jaws, and Steven Spielberg like wrote him a letter about how much he loved it. I mean, that's how special they were at the time. Yeah. It was, Must Love Dogs mixed with Jaws, or Jaws cut as like a rom-com.
Yeah, feature. That's really fun. I'm going to watch that.
Anyhow, I know we should wrap up, but I guess just like some general trailer tips. I just want to be prescriptive for a second is just, most of you probably know this, but if you are either cutting a trailer for something you made, your short or your feature, or writing a script for a trailer or doing a parody trailer or a pitch trailer, just really remember that trailers have like a very specific structure, that they're their own genre. Mm-hmm. And watch trailers, study them. And like one of the best things you can do is just to start off with three pieces of music, three tracks mm-hmm. That are going to split up your three acts of your trailer.
Can I mention a trend in trailers that sure. we thought about on this one, actually? So as a result of the skip button on YouTube, now mm-hmm. all trailers have a mini trailer before the real trailer starts. That's about 5 seconds long, basically. Oh,
like a Logan Paul type of thing where they're like, this is the coolest shot in the whole video. Oh, now I mean, watch the video. I think
the Marvel movies are an even better example, where it's like you get Doctor Strange and the villain, or a tease at the villain and like the craziest shot in the movie and the logo before
the trailer,
you know, the trailer starts. And sometimes they'll even be like, the trailer for the new Doctor Strange movie right. starts now, or whatever, you know.
I mean, if you want to maybe get a lot of views on YouTube, maybe something that's important, but I think,
well, but it is a filmic language now. So like if you're trying to make something that's meant to feel real for some reason, yeah. whatever that reason is, that is something that we observed. And again, because it was likely going to be airing a lot on digital, it was helpful for us for the same reason. So that it's helpful for Marvel movies even, you know?
Yeah. So anyway, trailers, I love them. Well, cool. Well, Matt, thanks for talking to me about trailer shooting. There's so much we haven't covered. And I think between the two of us, we know quite a few trailer editors, and we should have one of them on. I want to have Adam Mays, who cut like every big comedy trailer, like all the Hangover movies and stuff. I'm going to try to get him on because he's told me some crazy stories about mm-hmm. what makes a good trailer and how some movies are just really difficult to cut a trailer for, because that thing that we've mentioned before, no one in the movie ever says what the movie's about.
My wife's maybe her biggest regret about the movie that she directed that I produced, See You Next Christmas, available on all streaming platforms now. Go on iTunes, go grab it. Is that no one says like, the premise of the film. Like, I keep coming to this party and seeing the same people every year, and it's great to watch them grow, and all of our lives have changed and evolved, and we only see each other at this party.
Yes. Well, she's in the movie, so it's a very easy line to ADR.
Sure, that's true. That's true. Oren, do you have a minute or two more?
For an unpaid endorsement?
Unpaid endorsement.
Yes.
Unpaid endorsements!
Oren, we were talking about pitching, a thing that we often talk about on this show. Mm-hmm. And you recommended a podcast episode of All the Hacks, where a man comes on to talk about what he calls the WAC method, which is a way of just boiling down his pitching style into something super concise and getting it out in 3 minutes or less, basically. And it was a great episode. It was really helpful. And I think that all of our listeners should go listen to it. My endorsement is for that episode of All the Hacks with Brant Pindivik. But yeah, it was great. Thanks, Oren. And then my other one is for a musician who I discovered on TikTok. His name is Bradley Thomas Turner. And I actually messaged him to be like, hey, I love your music and I'd love to use it in a video. And we've struck up a conversation. He's letting me use the music, which is really great. I'm specifically endorsing Bradley Thomas Turner. Like I said, like kitschy, fun, really great, really, evocative music. But also in general, I'm endorsing the concept of making friends with other artists on the internet, which is a thing that I have kind of stopped doing over the years. But like a lot of my best friends, separate from college, all of the people that I got to know in the scene out here in Hollywood, I was internet friends with them first, you know. And so I thought, dang, I should be messaging people whose art I admire more, because it's nice to hear that from people, and it's nice to you know, have something to contribute to different artists and stuff. And so Bradley Thomas Turner, and just like, yeah, hit somebody up on TikTok if you think they're great, and like there's a way that you can work together. Like having an actual pitch, I think, is really helpful. I was like, hey, I love your music, I'd love to use it in this video, is that okay? But it was really nice.
I love that idea. One of my director buddies, Mike Ashton, I met because I just saw his videos online, and I was like, these are so good, and I emailed him like questions about them, and then we became buddies.
Yeah, there you go. And before you know it, you're like getting introduced to their different crew members, you're putting each other up for jobs. It's like
yeah,
It's like what we networking. Used to do. Yeah. Networking is kind of like a 4-letter word for some people, but also just like community building, helping each other, all that stuff. That's part of networking too. So it doesn't have to be bad. Anyway, those are my endorsements. Oren, what you got?
Okay, two quick ones. There's a Twitter thread from this guy named David Wappel, W-A-P-P-E-L. He's written like for some HBO shows and done some things, but the thread is called, here's a master thread of the 10 most common missed opportunities in scripts and screenplays from emerging or aspiring screenwriters. And he, you know, there's a lot of these threads on Twitter, but I liked his because it was very kind of, he has like very succinct descriptions, like not number one, not providing emotional glimpses into character. And then there's a Twitter thread you can go in to break it out to like what he means by that. You know, not creating dilemmas. My other endorsement is if you are putting in a pantry in your house.
Oh, tell me more. Actually, I am.
Put a freaking outlet in the pantry.
We have one.
Put outlets in closets, pantries, everything. In the bathroom, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. Like if you have like a cabinet that you're installing, put an outlet in there and your blow dryer can be plugged in. You just open it up and it's already plugged in.
Yeah.
Not that I use a blow dryer, but anything electric. I love, we put a pantry by our kitchen and we have an outlet in there and we charge the Dyson. Well, cool. Well, anyway, thank you for listening. We'd love to hear from you what you think about trailers, what you think about VFX and about animated GIFs and treatments and toasters. Please email us. We're justshootit@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. You can also tweet at us or contact us anywhere else on social media. We're at justshootitpod pretty much everywhere. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at SmiteyPyleg. And on Instagram, I'm at OKaplan.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow across all social media. This episode was edited by Noah Bayshore. Thanks, Noah. He also recommends the film Barbarian, which is probably going to be too scary for me. It looks real scary. It's my understanding that the less you know about it, the better. So if you like scary movies, Noah's recommending Barbarian. And he's going to go shoot his movie any day now. So good luck, Noah. The music you're listening to is provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist, Jazar. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.